I have the distinct pleasure today to be here today with Grim Grizz or Grizz Grim. Do you prefer to be called Grizz or Grim?
General.
General. Okay,
I'm
General.
General Griswold Gaius Grimm of the First LARP Ingression Protocol.
Okay, General. Well, you are going to be one of the honored guests, really, at the upcoming conference in Seattle, in Olympia. The Estuary Northwest 2024 conference in
Encountering
Olympia.
face to face.
And there's going to be actually a VIP luncheon on your behalf because of your birthday during that conference. Is that right?
We're doing dinner and D&D
Oh, dinner.
on the Sunday following the official conference, because the official conference ends on the 14th. But the VIP, the 12 VIPs, only 12 seats, few remain. We're gonna do dinner and D&D with rhubarb pie and bison brisket at the on the 15th, which will be the day of my birth.
I'm going to be really sorry to miss that because I love rhubarb pie. That's a highlight memory of my childhood. I have to fly back on the 15th.
Well, I can arrange some on the side for the conference. I'm sure I can get an early pie from Nate. We're close. We're close, me and him. I'm excited to hear your presentation there. And
Am too. I have no idea. I've started down five different roads, and I don't know. There's too much to say and too little time, and
say the word art three times during your presentation, you will have delivered, right? So other than that, just feel relaxed,
yeah.
Art three times and I'm good. Remember, Grimm told me that's all you really got to do. We're just gonna be glad you're there. And
Well,
Rafe
thank you.
Kelly, I'm
Yeah.
excited to about him being there. It's gonna be fun.
Yeah, I'm supposed to have a conversation with Rafe before this happens so that we kind of get an idea of, who's coming from where. But so far we haven't been able to schedule a time together. So I don't know. Anyway, I haven't met him yet, but I'm hopeful and looking forward to all the speakers. I think it's going to be terrific. So there's Rafe Kelly and Chris Green, who is a theologian, as I understand. And
I've seen him in videos around. There's
yeah.
video.
And then there is
Michael Martin.
Michael Martin, who is a biodynamic farmer and an author and a philosopher and a musician. He's done just about everything.
He's got this book called Jesus, The Imagination that I'm really fascinated to, but I haven't read yet.
Well, yeah, he actually puts out a magazine. I'm not sure if it's monthly or six times a year, that is a compendium of articles from a lot of different writers around that topic as well. And then there is Paul Vanderclay, who's the one who basically started the flotilla.
What? Who is that? I never heard of
Oh, yeah.
the guy. I have no idea.
And then there's one more.
There's a Graham, right?
Oh yes, Graham Pardoon, the poet. And I've read a little bit of his poetry. It's wonderful. That's going to be just terrific hearing him
I
speak.
hear that's what he's bringing to the stage at this event, so it should be good.
Yes. And then we're going to have all these wonderful estuary meetings, which
Yeah,
to
that's
me
the
was the
exciting part.
highlight of Chino, was the estuary meetings where you get to know everybody.
No, the highlight of Chino was Viveki gave me a hug. But
Oh.
the estuaries were good and they're gonna be great. I guess I'll be in one or several. So you could be sitting in a circle of a few people with me or this wonderful lady with the few remaining tickets. And we're also doing a 25 slots. I don't know how many are remain camping. Lodging for $100. We're putting up the tents and the sleeping bags and everything. You show up, give us $100. You got all 3 days of the conference in a tent and the campfire stuff, like at Chino. You didn't make it out to the campground, but
I
that's
did not. I hope to this time. I'm actually going to have a car, so I'll be able to make it out to the campground for the singing. I'm looking forward to the singing.
yes, it's a different group, but I'm trying to get everybody to do my shanty, the one I run on my show. I'm not gonna present not here, but it'll be fun. It'll be fun. I'm excited.
Well, we will put the link to your show in the description here so that people can hear your shanty. So the reason we're getting together today general is to talk about the proliferation of conspiracy theories in recent days. And the reason I got to thinking about this is that I kind of came into Christianity through a series of conspiracy theories that I ran into in 1979. And it was the kind of like the anxiety that built up from all those conspiracy theories that drove me to call out to see if there was a God out there who was bigger than I was, who could handle all these problems. And that's kind of how I came to the faith. And then I was so at peace that I put away all that research and just basically got on with life. And so I haven't been very interested in conspiracy theories. I'm very attracted to them because I'm a pattern-oriented person, so I see patterns everywhere. So good conspiracy theories are always very attractive to me because they have a pattern that's, very consistent, and it's like, oh, I can latch onto that and I can see it everywhere. And but I've tried to avoid them for, we're looking at 40 some years now. But when this thing happened at Butler, which I will not mention because I don't want to get my show shut down, when this thing happened in Butler, Pennsylvania, I got very intrigued by all the things that were coming out for the first couple of weeks. And there were many different rabbit trails to go down, and they all had these very coherent stories. And they couldn't all, the reason I knew that some of them at least were conspiracy theories is that they couldn't all be true. Because they were disagreeing with each other. So, but what I noticed that was consistent in all of them is that some of them were using something like a deep fake or were taking old film and then calling it something new, attaching labels to stuff that shouldn't have been labeled that way. And it got me to thinking, would there be a reason for somebody to want to see conspiracy theories proliferate? Because in so doing, they might very well get a lot of people engaged in activities that aren't very useful. Because I blew almost 2 weeks of my life going down all these rabbit trails
Oh
when
no,
I could have
only
been,
2 weeks, huh?
yes, when I could have been. Preparing my talk for Olympia. So I kind of wondered what you thought about that.
Well, I think my entire generation was programmed to be conspiracy theorists. Like, we got the fourth network came out with the Fox, and one of its premier flagships was the X-Files, right? Which is that. And so I think it's a demographic market for the attention. Like, they know, like, whenever there's gonna be an event that they're gonna spawn, like, conspiracy theories are going to spawn. So there's people that are just like, at this point in our attention warfare, people just trying to get clicks are gonna participate in that fashion for just out of self-interest. But as far as whether there's been a conspiracy to proliferate, I think, see, because I don't know, the whole conspiracy thing is, A, things are not as they seem, and B, there's malice at the top. I mean, that's the root of most conspiracy thinking, right? And it seems, if that's the case, what's ha been happening for the last 4 years or so is the intentional destruction of reputation of information sources. Well, if you listen to The Replacement, like Russell Brand and Joe Rogan, that's what's happening, is the legacy media, the papers and everything, which are owned by what, four families maybe? And all, when you see all the papers echoing the same tune, and then that tune is later, I don't know, a Russian collusion. No, wait, that wasn't real. That kind of thing. When the there's no reason for the newspapers to destroy their own credibility other than they have to from the top down. And so it seems like it's intentional that. So I don't know the, where I've wound this
Just
around.
let me clarify here. So intentional from the top down is the intention to simply control the content, or is the intention to humiliate the information sources? Because, for example, this recent one that just happened, weird. You saw the thing with weird, right?
That was
Where
weird, wasn't it?
everybody started using the word weird on the same
I call
day.
that event itself a weirding.
Okay.
Right?
So the recent weirding, do they each realize that by participating in that, they are making themselves look like fools? Do they realize it and they're doing it because they've been told to do it? Or do they not realize it and they're just getting humiliated accidentally?
Where are you on your understanding of kayfabe?
What you mean, like wrestling?
Like the concept of kayfabe itself, as a saying, you pull it away from the. I mean, they use it in wrestling. You can see it in wrestling. We understand it in wrestling, but the thing itself isn't exclusive to wrestling. It's the meta hyper object kayfabe, right?
Okay, so tell me about kayfabe.
It's let's call it participatory scripted reality. So Santa Claus is also kayfabe. Like that's a good understanding of how, like, well, we embody the Christmas spirit by following the script of this thing we know is like the script makes it look like it's actually happening. But and then we all
So
follow.
it only works if we participate. We're sort of like with wrestling, you're sort of in on the secret, nevertheless, you're participating.
Right, there's like layers of it. That's why I asked if how familiar you were, because like there's people who participate who don't know it's fake. There's people who participate that know that do know it's scripted, and then there's the people writing the script, right? So there's the three layers in operation. And most conspiracy theories are about which level is doing what in a whatever event, right? So, but
Well, the reason I ask that, I want to show you this little film clip.
okay.
I often listen to well, that's crazy. Guess we have to do it this way. I often listen to Michael Levin's Academic Channel.
Thank you for
You
that.
know who Michael Levin is, right?
Yes, he'll never speak to me, and I really admire his work.
Well, he has an academic channel on which he speaks to a lot of people in different academic arenas than he is in. And he'll talk to like anybody about anything. And so there's always these very interesting crossovers. And today he was the one that published today. He was talking. I don't know who it actually is that he's talking to. The guys' names are Daniel McShay and Gunnar Babcock. Can you see this screen?
I can.
Okay. So Daniel McShay and Gunnar Babcock probably have something to do with neuroscience, maybe, or something. Anyway, they're having this conversation, and then this happens.
It's a top-down kind of thing. It's totally consistent with our view of field theory of how fields govern lower level things within them. We've got a lot to agree about there. One, not roadblock, but one issue for us is how human motivation is encoded. And
Okay, so just that, I just want to sit. Just look at that much, okay? I'm going to run it again because I think it's pretty important.
I think I know you. It's a top-down kind of thing. It's totally consistent with our view of field theory of how fields govern lower level things within them. We've got a lot to agree about there. One, not roadblock, but one issue for us is how human motivation is encoded.
So they're in this larger discussion of cellular collectives scaling up to control development and maintenance and repair and so forth in the body. And then they're also talking about it at the neuronal level of the neurons in the brain controlling different aspects of the body, and then scaling it up to if we went would scale that up into the human social level, okay, and you start thinking about how at the higher level fields govern the lower level things. So if we're the lower level things, us little folks here, and the field is this world of ideas that can be captured by let's call them propaganda fields. Let's say that we're surrounded by a whole bunch of propaganda fields, and some of those propaganda fields are different ideologies that are out there that capture some people, and some of the propaganda fields are just seemingly right now what I see is a proliferation of conspiracy theories just getting thrown out there to just in the same way that legacy media has been when put in a position of being mistrusted by everybody. That took place over a certain number of years. And now all of a sudden, it's like these conspiracy theories have filled up the field out there. But those fields don't work without the participation of the lower level entities. So even the fields that are governing the lower level cells in the body, those don't function unless the lower level cells are drawn towards and functionally making the effort to participate in the higher level field.
Well, since we're saying field, I'm thinking the biological parts like tune in like the frequency to a field for some reason, right?
Yeah, I think when he talks fields, he's talking about a lot of different levels, but certainly that would be one level. Levin talks about the electrical, the bioelectrical signals, and that they form some kind of a field that the cells are responding to, are using, they're using that field to communicate with one another. So if you and I are using a field of ideas to communicate with one another, if that field gets mucked up with a whole lot of conspiracy theories that actually prevents us from being able to communicate clearly with each other about what's actually happening.
It's that's there's a some Yuri guy's 1970 whatever presentation made the rounds, and about it's the goal being for no one to know what's actually true, because that's when it's real easy to take control, because then it's
Yuri Bezmenov or something like that. Yeah.
his presentation was it's really enlightening to what might be going on. But I think that's the thing, is like we're in a world where how can normie still mean like doesn't think there's something going on? Because the conspiracy theories that I've seen generated since that Butler did it was have been from the side that normally doesn't generate conspiracies and is the one calling conspiracies. It seems that they're now suggesting people conspired to mislead others. So everyone's making conspiracies. There's that's the novelty of the Butler situation, as I see it, is the pro-government side is making the conspiracies. The conspiracies seem to lean in that direction instead of the other one, which is novel.
Well, that's exactly what makes me start to wonder about all this. Sometimes it just seems too very convenient. But at bottom, I think the reason it concerns me and what I said to you in the email was that I think getting involved in conspiracy theories has two main impacts on a person, and that is fear or immobilization. So when I went down, I was telling you that I kind of went down this track during the after the Butler event. I blew away 2 weeks that I could have been using more profitably. Basically, I got immobilized. I couldn't get off the screen because, oh, well, there's this other thing. And oh, well, maybe that doesn't make sense, but look, there's this other thing, and there's video to watch, and there's actual film of this happening or that happening. And so it was very effective in immobilizing me for 2 weeks. And I feel like I'm pretty impervious to these things. So I'm wondering if anybody else had the same experience. And it made me feel very manipulable. But conspiracy theories can also have the impact of fear. And I think we're not supposed to be living in fear,
Be
but
not afraid.
be power, love, and a sound mind instead of fear, right?
Well, at least be not afraid. That other part I haven't gotten to. But be not afraid is often enough repeated that I can hold on to it, right? So you say these things about what the butler did, and I live in a world where they're 1984-ing down the memory hole that the butler exists at all. And what's going to happen to you people in your situation's sense of reality when the rest of the reality dictates that Mandela didn't die in prison? I'm probably losing you. I'm speaking in coded language on purpose, but am I? Do I need to clarify? Do you get what I'm saying?
Well, I just find it very interesting that you're saying that because I lived through all those years. And some things I remember very, very clearly. So when they memory hole something or they try to say it in a new way, I can say, wait a minute. I was there. I remember very clearly, right? For example, let's say President Reagan's attempted assassination. I remember that very clearly. I was a representative in the Iowa House of Representatives, and we were on the floor debating some tax issue or something. And the news came in that the president had been shot. And I remember the feeling of the whole place just drawing together, both parties drawing together in concern over that, during the whole time until we knew that he was okay. I remember that. So if they try to come in and say to me, oh, that never happened, or Reagan was never president or something, I know for sure. But when you bring up Mandela, I can't remember because I think I remember him coming out of prison and being a great hero.
You did. That's the reality we actually live in. The
Okay.
thing
So
we
what is
met,
this other reality then?
it's the mental condition where he died in prison, and we remember him dying in prison and reading the news articles about it and stuff, and then find ourselves in a reality where he was released from prison and yada yada. And that's what I see happening with the event because there's been people. I've seen videos of Google searches that suggest that some things are becoming really hard to find regarding the butler. And when that happens, it what can be divisive other than people remembering more divisive than people having different memories of reality or people's narrative reality being, including things that your memory said happened that are no longer there. Like the
Well, and
amount of
the
division.
thing that's been very concerning to me over the last, and I started to see this maybe in 2008. There was a certain president that served between 2008 and 2012, whose name I won't mention. But when that president was serving, I started to notice that he would give a speech proclaiming that he was going to do certain things. And then within like a week, he was doing exactly the opposite of what he had said he was going to do. And when he proclaimed that he was going to do them, the press was building him up as a great, prophet of the future. And then when he did exactly the opposite of what he had said he was going to do, the press said, "Well, this was a brilliant move, and this is the way of the future." And this kept happening so that like people could be manipulated within a week to believe exactly the opposite of what they had heard the week before. And I just found that really interesting. And recently, it seems it's not even a week. It can be within 3 days, or maybe sometimes even the same conversation.
It's well, if the American dream is that we're free, and it's a kayfabe dream, the scary thing becomes, what's the alternative when everybody wakes up with how it's functioning now? The path you took to the cons you dipped out early after 2 weeks, right? I can speak to what another path through the conspiracy thing is like, and that's through the transition into a truther, where what you find in the conspiracies isn't regarding a single issue, but enough you find something that's believably true that is a conspiracy, so it counts, but it's so horrendous that you get the mistaken impression that if everybody knew this was happening, it would stop happening. And that can be you can spend a lot of time there and trying to wake up other people to what you found because it's so horrendous and you're so, that's a bigger threat, I think, than wasting a little time and being a little scared. But
Well, I totally understand what you're saying there, because back in 1979, when I had stumbled on this garden variety group of conspiracy theories that all sort of tied together, I had videotapes. Can't remember what kind of machine we're using back in 1979, but I was inviting the neighbors in to watch these videos. Because I thought if people just understood that this was happening,
somebody would do something.
somebody would do something. And well, that's probably how I ultimately got elected, because it did create some at least notoriety about me. And
That you cared about things people didn't have time to care about.
yes, and that I cared about the people that were being hurt by this thing. But ultimately, I didn't feel that that use of my time was the wisest use of my time. I mean, and I won't say that being in the legislature for 2 years was the wisest use of my time either, because then that's another whole long story. But you discover very quickly that when you're in a power position, that you have very little power to actually do anything for your constituency. All the power that you have is to support your party, regardless of which party it is. And that becomes old very quickly, because if you're there to help your constituency, then what's the purpose of being there if you can't,
Well, your constituents belong to the party, hoping the party helps them. And it's a trap. It's that, and it's part of the illusion because all of your constituents have the illusion that you're going to be able to do something when you get there, right? It's like, that's the kayfabe that keeps us free. Is see the we all play along like we have freedom. I don't know what's happening to it, but as far as information sources, we're shy of trustworthy ones. For sure, especially in the world now that like I think it would take the right person less than half an hour to have this conversation be you and the president that shall not be named instead of with me, right? Like it could be him speaking to you the way he speaks, or and so now we can't even trust video anymore. Which is why the estuary 2024 is such an important event,
Yes.
because it establishes a protocol that teaches you how to talk to your fellow man about confusing events in a safe environment and this regular human-to-human interaction. And that establishing trusted human communication networks might be the proper response to our current fun times. Fun times.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, that's why. So, what I was thinking about with this issue of fields, you know, so let's say that there's a field of conspiracy theories or a field of bad ideas out there that don't work unless we participate. But there's also a field of good ideas out there that don't work unless we participate. And we get to choose which field we're going to pay attention to. Now, some people might say, well, but if you don't know about the bad field, then you're not going to know how to avoid it, you know, and you're not going to know how to make a difference. But how much difference can you really make if all your time is spent worrying about what's happening in the bad field?
Right. When you're spending time in the bad field, you're usually looking for the nugget that will convince the people who can't see and give them eyes to see. And that's the mythological object that doesn't exist.
So good.
I mean, I've spent a lot of time looking for it because, like, for example, when one such object, which should be an object as far as I can tell, is the, we're having Abramovich build schools in Ukraine. Like, to me, that's like this magic nugget that should cure people of a certain blindness. And it doesn't. And the delusion that it ever did would be a waste of my time.
Do you want to say more about that?
Well, she does this thing called, she's an artist who does this thing called spirit cooking.
Oh, that's where I've heard the name before.
And they're having
So
her,
who's having her build schools in Ukraine?
the people in charge of who's going to be building schools in Ukraine, apparently. And her and schools is should be, like, as far as I can tell, that should be plenty for everybody that loves, that thinks we should be helping Ukraine, should be like, wait a minute, is what we're doing helping if this lady's building schools? And it turns out she's probably, I actually recently saw that she has a, she's a like an emissary-ish position with us. Like she's one of our emissaries for stuff. That's why she's building schools. So we're in a state where I could time travel to anything before 1990 and tell them what life is like now, and I would be blocked up for being insane. Like there's no way things are like that. So this. What can we do but get back together, look each other in the eye and say, I know this for sure, you know?
Well, yeah, to remember the things that we know for sure and to proclaim them to one another. But then, how important is it that those things that we know for sure be mythological facts about conspiracy theories? Right? So, and when you said that about looking for the mythological fact that's going to convince people, it really set off a lightning storm in my brain because I've been spending 5 years on my channel trying to find a way to describe to people this picture that I see inside my head of how the universe works at the most fundamental level of the universe being a work of art, right? That's in the process of being created, and
The way
that
songs
provides
in the
a
process of being played.
created.
Right, but it's created as it's played, right? It's like Go ahead, continue.
Yeah. Well, so anyway, this picture that I have in my head is a very beautiful picture. So I've been talking to scientists and philosophers and, chemists and biologists and everything, and seeing that picture in all these things that I talk to people about, I see what's happening, but I have not found a way to describe that it's like I'm looking for a mythological, right? A
I could pair of glasses
mythological
you could hand somebody.
artifact that I can hand, yeah, to hand somebody to say, see, can you see what I see? And recently, I've begun to have this feeling that maybe it's not possible, and maybe I'm just wasting my time.
If you're searching for that artifact, I would say yes. If you being able to see it lets you do something to a canvas nobody else can. Maybe they see it through what you put on the canvas. I'm
So this
kidding.
is where it comes in that action is more important than searching for the artifact, right?
I have dance so hard in my head right now, and it's like, you can watch the dance and then you look how beautiful the dance is. Look, Levin, Levin, you're a genius. If you could just see this dance, but like the only way he's going to see the dance is like you start dancing because you do see the dance and then people see the dance through you.
And that is what we can begin to engage through the estuary, is that we can be a model for others of how this dance operates in the world, not only through communicating with one another in the estuary protocol, but then taking that life that comes out of that communication and taking it back into our environments and acting upon it in our environment with other people who are outside the circle.
Carry water, right? That's the finally, right? For the longest time, they have that before enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. After enlightenment, chop wood, carry water. And I was like, well, then what the heck is the point of enlightenment? But if that's the water we carry, maybe there's value there after all.
I always feel like there's some secret inside your mind that I can't get at.
I believe I can't get at it either. Well, it's exciting times, exciting times.
What are you most hoping for from the Estuary Northwest 2024?
Well, honestly, there's just I've The most, a lot of my motivations for doing things in life are what I feel is commitments to roles or obligations to other people. And I've chosen as one thing I'm going to do for myself in life is go to a certain place on the planet. And where Estuary 2024 is within a couple hours. So that's my biggest excitement is I'm finally going to go because it's like, I don't know, a secret pact with existence kind of thing. And I'm like, what happens if you make it? I have no idea. We'll find out. But I mean,
What
that's,
what's the place?
I can't say. Keep the
Oh.
secret safe, you know? But
Okay.
it's,
Because I'm absolutely thrilled that my younger daughter is going to join me at Estuary. But the day before, we're going to drive a couple of hours away from where the estuary is, and we're going to go to Olympic National Park and spend the day out in the Great Northwest. So that's going to be pretty exciting.
that where the volcanoes are?
Oh, I don't know.
Well,
I don't know. What do you
tell
mean?
me when you get back, and we're both at the event, right?
Don't know. I just know we're driving over there. I mean, it's going to be a whirlwind trip because we're flying in, we're driving. It's a 2.5 hour drive from the airport to get there, and then driving back the same day, and then the next day picking folks up at the airport and driving down to Olympia. So.
Well, it's all beautiful, at least.
Yeah. There's almost no place on earth probably as beautiful as the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, especially when it's sunny. And hopefully we'll get sunny weather while we're there.
Should we should at least a day or so.
Yeah. So I have heard that Rafe Kelly is going to be doing some kind of move, evolve, move, play activity with us. Have you heard any more about that?
I don't know, but he is as far as the corner goes, like the only one I know really leaning hard on the embodiment. So he's the one to do it. That's great.
Yeah. And then Michael Martin and Graham Pardoon would be the ones that are leaning on the imagination. Well, I guess I lean on the imagination a little bit too, but I tend to get all up in there with all the sciencey factual stuff. I get trapped in that. It's hard to get back to the imagination thing. Well,
Can I
I
swing
can
you
be very
back to conspiracy
overanalytical.
for a while?
What?
We go back to conspiracy for a minute.
Oh, sure.
In one of our previous conversations, available on this channel, I recall you mentioning that you noticed what they were doing with the school.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Big time.
When that happened, could you have told anybody without being considered a conspiracy theorist what you saw happening in the schools and a brief recap of what you saw happening and what decade this was?
Sure. So I became aware that there was this move towards the schools through. So I was doing a lot of study. I got very, very interested in economics and history back in the late 70s because of the economic debacle that was happening during Jimmy Carter's presidency.
That the oil one or something else?
Well, that was part of it, but just everything in general started to fall apart, and it was obvious to everybody. So there were a lot of books being written about what to do, and there was going to be problems with the stock market, and I don't even remember what all, but I really got into it, and I started reading all these books. And then I stumbled on an organization called the Aspen Institute for Humanistic Studies, which is still around, except that back then they were much more open about what they were doing. And they had a newsletter that came out, I think, once a month or something. So I got on their mailing list and I started getting their newsletters. And one of the newsletters talked about how their goal was to take over the children of America so that they could educate them to become good global citizens for the New World Order. And I took a look at that, and I didn't know what humanism was back then, but I sure knew that I didn't want a New World Order with one leader and good global citizens being my daughter being turned into a good little global work person for the New World Order. So, but that did sound very much like a conspiracy theory. Except that, I mean, it's right here in their newsletter, right? So
Well, was it
then,
tactics on how they would be doing it, what they would be pushing in the schools or anything?
that I don't recall specifically in their newsletters, but what I do recall is that once I got interested in that, I started meeting a lot of other people that were coming to me with school books, textbooks that their children were being exposed to in Iowa. And the textbooks were very open about what they were doing, except that as a parent, how often do you read your kid's textbook, right? But in the textbook, it would say things like, your parents' values are outdated. You don't need to listen to them. You can develop your own values. And then there was a whole curricular movement called values clarification that would help children to develop their own values. And I don't know how old you are, so I don't know if you.
47.
Okay, so you're a little younger than my oldest daughter. She was in school at the time, And what they were teaching in values clarification is they would have these stories like there's a lifeboat and there's only room for 15 people on the lifeboat, but there's 18 people on the ship and the ship is going down. So how do you decide which 15 people end up on the lifeboat? And then they would describe all the people. There might be one who's a noted physicist. And then there might be another one who's an 82-year-old pastor. And then there's another one who's a pregnant mother. There's all these different people. So then you have to come to a decision. Well, this 82-year-old pastor, he's probably lived a long life. We can get rid of him, plus he's a pastor, he's a Christian, we don't need them.
Going straight to God, he'll be fine.
Yeah. So you whittle it down to 15 people. So you make these arbitrary decisions about who lives and who dies.
As a word problem and skew.
Yeah. So basically what you're doing is you're developing an elite mindset of what values actually means, right? So that was values clarification. And long about the same time, there was this other idea called situational ethics, which, if you boil it right down to the bottom, was love conquers all, but not biblical love, but the squishy kind of love, the soft, compassionate, what does JBP call them? The devouring mother kind of love,
The
right?
toxic empathy,
Yeah.
Munchausen.
If somebody murders somebody, you don't want to put them in prison because that wouldn't be the loving thing to do, because that kind of I'm exaggerating a little bit. But
That
my
kind of.
husband at the time was a teacher, and in Iowa at that time they had something called the Multicultural Non-Sexist Education Certification Requirement. And every teacher had to be certified in that requirement every year by taking a class, and the class, as I recall, was 6 weeks long or something. And the class was just one of these weird things where, like, they would have the teachers pretend to be a tree or have them lie on the floor and be a sponge. Or after I got into the legislature, some teachers would bring to me packets of material that were given to them in this program. And one of the packets of material proclaimed that Jesus and John had been homosexual lovers. And they were putting this out to the teachers to normalize certain activities, together with little pamphlets on where to find partners if you were having a hard time finding partners. This is 1980, and this is in Iowa. And so at the time, it was quite startling. And
That such
I.
things would make it through the approval process that's in place to protect educational materials.
Well, as I'm trying to take you down the rabbit hole now. Okay. So I'm in the legislature, and I find out that I always thought that the Iowa schools were operated by the local school board approving textbooks and curriculum and so forth. But this was shortly after the Department of Education had been created at the federal level. And so Iowa had adopted an early program from the federal Department of Education to divide up into 15 area educational agencies. So instead of it being county level or local level, the state had, I believe, 100 counties, but they divided up these counties sort of arbitrarily into 15 areas. And each one of those areas would receive the curriculum from the federal government, and then they would disperse it down to the local level. So all the curriculum is coming in from the, not all of it, but much of the curriculum is coming in from the federal level. And so I ended up being a chair of a subcommittee of educational regulations in the legislature. And I thought, okay, great, we can explore this certification requirement for multicultural non-sexist education, because I could tell that that was going to remove the teacher's ability to teach according to what they felt was most appropriate, age appropriate, and everything for the students, and have to kind of adhere to this new
So it was like the fact of deciding the curriculum and what books got in and stuff, that committee group, the multicultural, what?
No, that's just to kind of brainwash the teachers to make them willing to accept whatever came their way.
Okay.
And then you have the curriculum itself. So I asked the head of the Department of Education in Iowa to come and testify before the committee. So I had a chance to ask him some questions, you know, like, so how does values clarification work in the classroom? And he said, we consider that foundational in our educational system here in Iowa. So we want to see values clarification concepts integrated into every curricular level. So whether you're talking about English or history or physics. And I said, well, could you tell me how values clarification works in physics? And he said, oh, yes. He said, you know, in physics, if a unstoppable object hits an immovable object, you know, there's a certain thing that happens in physics. But if we look at it from a values clarification lens, how does the brick wall feel when it gets hit by the unstoppable object?
Then you rebuked him in the name of Jesus, right?
Well, there's only so much you can do when you're a state representative. And I am exaggerating a little bit, but not very much. And I ended up reading research from parents, not only in Iowa, but also in Arizona, because it seemed that both of those states were kind
pilot
of
programs.
Yeah, pilot programs for the whole system. Because remember, this is 1980.
I didn't know the Department of Education was a new thing. You said it. When did that come about? Like the 70s?
I can't remember whose term it came into, but it was relatively recent.
And that's when they really started, because once the Fed can like bribe schools with, hey, do you want $4,000 per student?
Yeah. Here comes the money.
Just teach them this. Yeah. Okay. That makes a lot.
And then one of the other ways that they got this curriculum into the schools is by giving big grant money to the state institutions. So Iowa State University.
And then the university says, we want the people you send to us to have this certification before they get here.
I believe it was the home economics department at Iowa State University that got this big grant money to develop a family planning curriculum or parental, I can't remember what they called it. You know, they always put a name on it that has nothing to do with it.
Or the exact opposite.
Yeah. So they developed this whole curriculum that was basically a sex education program, but kind of redefined as family planning or something like that. And I got hold of a copy of this through one of the parents that was in my district, or in my one of my colleagues' districts, was also a teacher. And so she had been to this teacher training thing. And she said during the training, when they were training them for this, to use this curricular program, one of the first things they did was have them sit in a darkened room with a big, what did they used to call them? Like a movie screen. It has
The slide one?
A projector screen. I can't remember. It rolled down. I can't remember what they called it. Rolled up, and then you could pull it down, and then you have this big screen in front of the class. Anyway, there's this big screen, and they've got a projector, and they're projecting vulgarities in brightly fluorescent colors all over the screen. And they're having people shout out the words that they see on the screen. And then they're saying, if you have difficulty saying these words out loud, then you should go into your closet at home and say them over and over again until you can say them without being embarrassed. Because you have to be able to talk about these things in the classroom when you're using this curriculum. And one of the lessons in the curriculum was to get the kids in the ninth grade to pair up with a boy girl at each table, and the boy and girl were supposed to get their heads together and figure out all the vulgarities that they had heard on the playground, and then write them down, whatever kind of sexual proclivities or whatever they could think of, and write them down on a piece of paper. And then they put it in a basket, and then the teacher takes one out of the basket and reads the word, and she says, "Okay, this is the vulgar use of this word, but here's the actual medical terminology for this, and here's how it works." That was a mild part of the lesson. I mean, there were lesson plans in there that I had to scrub out of my mind because they were so disturbing.
Wow.
And
And
so I thought,
that's sex education?
it was called family planning or something. So I, or parental, I can't remember. I wish I could remember. I and some of my colleagues thought if people knew about this, they would stop the funding for this immediately. So what I did was we put together copies of this material and we put it into manila envelopes and we had them distributed around the house floor. There were 100 representatives. Every one of them got an envelope. And the way it works, you have all these desks in a semicircle around the floor, and everybody has a mic at their chair. And at a certain time in the afternoon, this guy pops up with his mic and he says, "How dare you send filth like this to our desks through the hands of these pages who are high school students?" And so we said, "Well, yes, obviously. We don't want high, we put them in sealed envelopes, but this is being used as curriculum in the schools."
The
Well,
ninth grade.
that's different because those are teachers and they know what they're doing, and you don't know what you're doing. So you have no right to send this around to these pages without a teacher being involved. So if the teachers are there, it's perfectly okay. And when we tried to stop the funding for it, and we did everything. I mean, we had special committee meetings, we had a public hearing, and the PTA and the NEA came to the public hearing and testified on behalf of the material. They did everything they could to make us look like absolute bumbling idiots. They called me an archaic anachronism of an ancient age. And some like, bimbo, some kind of bimbo. I can't remember. They were always using alliteration.
Hey, I'm a fan. I'm a fan.
So anyway, at the end of the day, we got 15 votes and they got 85 votes.
And it was,
After a month of trying to make this public to people,
and that was 1980.
that was 1980.
And there's a they that's pushing weird stuff on the kids.
Well, it's coming down from the federal level, and I don't know who was influencing it at the federal level, but what I did, you asked me what I did. So what I did was I thought the only way out of this is private schools or homeschooling. So I set up a statewide tour and I drove all around the state of Iowa and I talked to any group that would have me. And I gave my little shtick and I gave them all the data that they needed. And I told them, you got to start homeschooling. You got to start private schools. You got to get your kids out of the public school. Now, at the end of the day, I don't know how effective that was. I do think that the homeschooling movement has grown since then, but I don't know if my participation had anything to do with it. But I got unelected at the end of that term because obviously I had a target on my back.
85% of the thing voted against this candidate on
Well,
her anachronistic view
yes.
of the education. Yeah.
Well,
You
that wasn't the thing that killed me. The thing that killed me was standing up against my own party on an issue that was very important to the party. And so they ran somebody against me in the primary who could take me out in the primary, even though that person couldn't win the regular election. They took me out in the primary, which was all was needed. So they lost that seat and subsequently lost the majority in the House at the same time. So,
But they'll lose a seat to keep the party in line. Yeah, that makes
yeah,
sense.
too bad for them. They lost the seat, they lost the majority.
So in light of that, right, we have the kayfabe of the American dream that all the organizations at the top are run by good people who want good things for you. There's no way that the FDA would approve aspartame if it wasn't safe for you, for your Diet Cokes, And the kayfabe is like we play along with those organizations are doing their jobs, and we don't have this system where, all right, men, like for me it's for men. Women, you figure out how you want to do it, but we lack an initiation into manhood. Because it's good to keep the kayfabe, because we want our kids to think the world that we project is the world we're aiming for, right? Is what we project with the kayfabe. It's like that's the society we're aiming for, so we act like we're already there. The kids grow up believing that's how things are supposed to be. But and then at some point we pull them aside and say, all right, look, most of this is held together by blackmail and but we don't have that part. And so everybody stays in the dream. And that you see all these conspiracy th things is just are people trying to get through to people still dreaming that the world is way darker than you've been led to believe. I don't know. That's my take, I guess. But we don't,
I
we
think what I heard you just say is that there is a good side to maintaining the fiction, because that helps our children to grow up with some stability instead of growing up with fear. But there's also a time that has to come when people are integrated into the larger reality that we actually exist in. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, it's and I'll even tie it to fields for you, right? Imagine just for a moment that a child's imagination is the most important variable in the frequency of the field, right? Like if the kid's growing up dreaming and imagining horrors, then the field itself is more likely that so we if we protect the imagination of children, like it brings a greater harmony to the field altogether, or something like that.
So we have some participatory power in maintaining a field that's healthy for our children. Is that what you're
I
saying?
think so. I think so. I think that, but at on the same hand, I think that once people aren't children anymore, they need to be in as soon as possible indoctrinated to the realities of the world we live in, because you can't shine bright enough until you see how dark it is, I guess. But yeah, I think the children need to grow up in under a layer of protection. I think they're our best hope. So
Well, so I get what you're saying. I'm thinking about it on the adult side. Obviously, we don't want to live unaware of the kayfabe nature of things, but at the same time, I don't think we want to live scurrying around trying to find the mythological thing that's going to convince everybody or indoctrinate everybody in the reality, because then we don't get anything done. I mean, this is one of the things that I think is so brilliant about what Jordan Peterson has done and why I think he's been so effective is that he simplifies everything down to the absolute bare minimum. At least the way when I listen to him, I hear this very simplified format that you clean your room. cleaning your room doesn't mean obviously your bedroom. It means, cleaning out your own mind and life and the way that you're functioning and all of that kind of stuff so that you can be active in the world. Because if you're not actively participating in the world in whatever way that you can, then you get static and stultified and rigid, and you won't persist. So you have to be acting, you have to be attempting, you have to be trying things, and then you're always bringing something new in, and then you're growing, and then you become more able to help yourself and the people around you, and then the larger world. But if I'm all inside, scurrying around, looking at all these things on the internet, trying to find the solution so that I can convince other people of the picture that I see, then I become very ineffective because I'm not acting in the world on what I know or on what I've learned or what I hope to know. So there's got to be something. It almost seems as though the game is to keep us from acting. The game is to keep us so involved in all this weird stuff that we become ineffective and we become immobilized. We become fearful and isolated.
The game is to keep your attention outside of your zone of proximal influence. The quest to find the thing to show other people is an attempt to get other people to do something about it, not finding what is the small thing I can do about it.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. Somebody else should fix this.
A lot of times that's true. I'm like, should I call a plumber or should I educate myself on plumbing? I don't know. There's two paths. They both make sense. People who have jobs such as protecting the ser their name is Child Protective Services, should be protecting the children, and those jobs exist for a reason. So it's, but. Hopefully there's accountability measures in place and those people are doing their jobs. The kayfabe is everybody's doing their job right. And I don't know. It's yeah. But yes.
Well, okay, so I think here's where it gets simple again, General, is that once you understand one simple thing about the world, well, first of all, either God exists or he doesn't. I happen to live in the world where God exists.
He
In the world,
believes in me, as far as I can tell.
yeah, and the world where God exists, sin exists. And once you have that picture and you understand that sin exists and that you are also a part of the sin that is existing, then you recognize that sin also exists in other people. And you would never live in a world in which you think everybody's doing their job the best way they can, because that's not the way it works, because sin exists. So yes, you want to live with trust, because that's what keeps a civilization together. There has to be a certain level of trust. But there also has to be a certain level of reality, understanding that sin also exists. So I will trust up to a point, but I think it was Reagan used to say, trust but verify. Right? So rather than living in fear, oh, everybody is evil. All the, what we see from certain people is all the evil's out there. And so we want to do away with evil people. There's one side of that looks at it that way, and then the other side looks at it. The evil runs right through every human heart. So every person has to be continually aware of that tendency of evil in the in your heart, and looking towards the good so that you're not focused on the evil, because you become like what you focus on. So if you focus on conspiracy theories, then you become like that. So if there are people using conspiracy theories as a way to manipulate, then we have to recognize that the more that we focus in on what they're showing us, the more we're going to become like them. We're not going to become like moving towards the better thing.
For me, just remember, can you make an influence on what you're spending your attention on? It's not that usually, as far as conspiracy theories go. But on the other hand, for me, how you said people need to realize that there is sin in the world, and everybody doing their job right isn't going to happen. Don't be blindsided by the fact. But that's what we're aiming for, is everybody doing their job right. So that it that's for me, you can look into it's wise to look into conspiracies until you shatter the illusion that everything is, it's like the Gelman amnesia, but instead of newspaper articles, it's just that society's running as smoothly as it appears to be, I guess. I don't that look into conspiracies until you fix yourself of that and realize that without you doing something, things might fall apart. I mean, I look at things like how much time somebody will spend talking about presidential candidates, and then, hey, do you know who represents you at the state level? Do you know who's on your city council? Or are you paying attention to things you have really, I'm going to have influence over this once in another 3.5 years. God bless us, everyone, right?
Yeah, I mean, I look back and for many years I didn't get involved in this stuff at all. And then after 9/11 happened, I got into watching the news again. And so for about 8, 10 years after that, I was just really into the whole political thing. My husband used to say to me, "Why are you sitting here night after night reading all this stuff? It's only going to upset you. There's nothing you can do about it." And then I would say, "Oh, but I need to understand so that I can influence other people so that I can make a difference, you know?" Just all just a big bogus waste of time. And all it did was create an environment in my household of fear, because instead of me being confident that the Lord was in control and that I don't need to fear. I can walk in, peace and recognizing his power and that he's going to give me discipline and a sound mind. I don't have to walk in fear. Instead, I'm like, "Oh my gosh, you can't believe what they're doing, and they're going to do this and they're going to do that." And I got myself so worked up over this. And then somewhere along about, I think 2012, maybe.
That
Hold
was the
on.
boiling point.
2011, somewhere in there, my daughter was tasked with reading 1984 for one of her high school classes. So I thought, well, I'll read it at the same time so we can talk about it. And I read it, and I hadn't read it for many, many, many years. In fact, I don't think I ever really finished it the first time I started reading it. When I read it in 2011 or something like that, I got to the end of it and I thought, oh my gosh. This book isn't about what they say it's about. We're all being played. We're just being played. Everybody on every side is being played all the time. And it was so obvious to me. And then I just dropped out again. I thought, I'm not going to participate in this game. It's not a useful game.
But it's sad because of how many useful, wonderful people are swept up in unuseful things.
Well, I mean, I think about what I could have accomplished if I, when I think about all that I've accomplished since I ran into Jordan Peterson in 2016 or 2017, if I had been putting that same amount of effort into knowing and understanding and living my life as I have done since then, I just can't imagine what, and back then I was younger, I had more energy, I could have accomplished amazing things. Instead, I'm wasting my time on Drudge Report, and hotair.com. And well, anyway, I'm just hoping we can all do better from here on out.
I think we might have to. So, yeah, be not afraid.
Be not afraid.
I think, but if you don't know, I don't, there's something in there about the prince of this world, and that's how things are run. That's why that's in it, but not of it, because of it is the current prince, and it's as dark as that really means. So.
Well, but that's almost the beautiful part of it, is that if you think of it as being the prince of this world, the darkness and the demonic, we're already told that in the name of Jesus, the darkness will flee. So we don't need to be in fear about that at all. I think people get more fearful about the they that operates all the conspiracy theories than they do about demons, because they don't really believe demons are real, but they certainly believe that they out there with the conspiracy theories is real. But that they with the conspiracy theories, we have no power over them at all, because we don't even know who they are or even if it's true. But if it's demonic power, in the name of Jesus, they will flee. That simplifies things greatly
Yeah.
and allows us to be cheerful, happy warriors, knowing that in Christ, all is well. Does that sound too simple?
It's awful fun to be worried and scared and excited, though.
It is. It's very tempting, because then we feel important somehow, right? It's a deep feeling of importance, like I know something. I want to know. That's the feeling I had when I was pursuing the butler thing. Oh my
What
gosh.
really happened?
Maybe I know something that nobody else knows, you know, and then I bookmark it so I can show somebody else later. Look at this thing I found. It's very self-important making.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's a
And
prime motivation.
I think that's what we have to fight against, because that's what they're using to keep us immobilized.
Well, see, they are setting up interference fields because the base field of reality is conscious love, and that's probably being in conscious love and being in Christ are really close together. And if you're in fear, you're not in that. So be not afraid.
Because there is no
But
fear in
verify.
love for yeah, there is no fear in love.
Yeah, so don't look unless you need to wake up to how bad it is. But and don't think you can wake other people up. That's a grace issue as well as the
Yeah,
salvation.
and I don't think, since the Bible already tells us how bad it is, why do we need to look at that stuff to know how bad it is, you know? It already says that in the in it there will come a time when the darkness is so dark that even little me is going to shine like a star in the universe, just because in the darkness, even a little light will shine brightly.
That's the best I got is like, man, it's dark here. I must be the light or a vehicle for it.
Shine brightly, General. Shine brightly.
Well,
And do not fear. Have a great day.
thank
And
you
I will
very
see
much.
you in Olympia.
Yeah, Olympia.
Bye bye.
Bye.